Hey team, you're about to experience my interview with Joe Wild. Joe is the founder and MD of Mac Digital out of Ireland, and Mac Digital are an e-commerce agency, they are a consultancy, they are digital strategists, and ultimately they are builders. And they also have a deep, deep specialization in B2B e-commerce and B2B marketing strategy in particular. And Joe and I had a fantastic conversation about the current state of B2B e-commerce and how brands can evolve towards being more digitally led. We had a great conversation. We dug deep and we got into some topics that I haven't covered too much before. So I think you're going to enjoy. Welcome to B2B Commerce Corner. Commerce Corner is a sub-series of the E-Commerce Edge podcast discussing all things B2B commerce through the lens of agencies, consultants, merchants, and more. Enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Pod. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome Joe Wild from Mac Digital to the podcast. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here with you guys, Jason.
My pleasure, mate. It's great to have you along for the ride today. And I think we've been trying to set this up for maybe 3 months now. We've been trying to make our schedules connect, and it's been a challenge, but we finally made it happen.
We have. I was nearly going to have to cancel today, but I said, there's no way. I can't do it anymore. I have to just get on here.
I'm glad you did. I'm glad you put your foot down, and I'm glad you made time for me. I really appreciate it.
No problem at all. Delighted to be here.
Look, as the head of a digital agency, what I wanted to talk about today is really the state of B2B e-commerce. I know you guys specialize in B2B e-commerce. And man, has this whole B2B e-commerce thing absolutely exploded. I think the fuse was lit when COVID happened. And then I think a whole lot of B2B brands realized, oh, geez, we're really not ready for this whole digital thing. We're not really ready to have e-commerce be our primary route to market. We've got field sales, we've got AEs, we've got customer service. We've got this big physical operation inside of our business designed to drive sales, and maybe we don't even have a marketing department, or maybe we got one person that does marketing, but mostly we're a sales-driven org, we're a human-driven org, we're a relationship-driven org. And all of a sudden, when COVID hit, I think everybody realized, geez, when our salespeople can't go out and visit people, when we can't easily maintain these relationships physically in person anymore, we've got to have some sort of a safety net in here. Oh, and by the way, oh gosh, we really think that a lot of our customers would actually really like us to offer e-commerce, but we don't, because obviously there's a new generation of buyers out there too. So it feels like a whole lot of things came together all at the same time during COVID. And I'm just wondering, did you witness the same thing?
Absolutely. So what I saw was, most of my work is in the B2B space. I do some work in the B2C space, and I also do a lot of work in education as well. So I try and sit myself somewhere between what academically says is going to happen and what happens in the real world. And I try and marry those two worlds just to give you a picture of what I do. But what I found, and I always use the analogy that B2C was at a party, and B2B didn't know that the party was even on. Okay? And then when COVID hit, it was like, oh my God, what's this thing happening over here? That there's some sort of music coming from here. We better get there. And so one of the things I did over COVID is that I developed a program in B2B marketing for the types of companies you've been speaking about. And I didn't even frighten them with B2B e-commerce. It was just B2B. As you say, some of them didn't even have a marketing person, or some of them, in one instance, it was, oh, you're doing what, health and safety? You like marketing, don't you? Okay, you're the new marketing director. And there was this grapple for, okay, what do we need to do now? So I put together this program on B2B marketing that would nearly give them a whistle-stop tour of where they needed to be. Wouldn't give them a full branding, but nearly, here we go. Here's a quick kind of dummy's guide for how you get to where you need to get to. So what I saw was B2C companies, and I've worked with a lot of the big brands through the years, like Diageo, Heineken, and Nestle. They're so advanced. Their marketing is so advanced. Their standing of the consumer is so advanced, okay? Well, where I saw B2B was, oh, what do we do now? We can't physically go and shake somebody's hand. We can't. They're not responding to our calls because nobody responds to calls anymore. And now, how do we get in touch with our clients? So I've seen this, my role has been to try and help those companies, particularly those who maybe are at the restart of their journey, and help them move forward and bring themselves into the B2B world, B2B e-commerce world, because that's the way the customer is changing. And I have one, a long-standing client who said to me 6 years ago, he said, and it's a big organization, he said, I used to walk onto a building site and I would shake invariably a guy's hand and I'd do a deal for €2 or €3 million. That's done. He said, now, he said, I know. They've no idea who I am because I don't have a LinkedIn profile. They look at my website and they go, that's rubbish. And they go, okay, next. So he says, I know I'm losing business as a result of not being up to speed with consumer behavior trends, with CX, with omnichannel, and with e-commerce.
Wow, this is so interesting because even some of these brands, they might have been doing EDI for years for their biggest customers. And so they are doing digital commerce without even realizing it in some respects. And or maybe they've got a punch out system or something like that for procurement personnel on the buying side to be able to pull down a catalog, make a purchase, and then it and ultimately ends up in an ERP. But to a lot of these business leaders, that's just magic. That's just, it may as well be magic because they go, I don't really know how it works, but I know it works. And I know we have these orders that just come in randomly from time to time. And then we process them and it all feels like it all just happens in the ether. And all of a sudden now they're faced with a situation where buyers are maturing. Buyers are the next generation, right? So we've got two things happening. We've got on the selling side, we've got the next generation of sellers trying to take over from maybe parents or grandparents that started the company 20, 30, 40, 50, 80 years ago. And when they started those B2B businesses, oftentimes they were the sole authorized distributor of a product or a brand or a range or into a region. And therefore, they didn't actually have to be that good at what they did because any inquiry that came into the manufacturing brand's inbox or via carrier pigeon or whatever, that lead would automatically just get sent straight to the distributor, right? And so they didn't really have to have a pipeline. They didn't have to be too good at selling. They didn't have to be good at marketing at all. And really, we had this kind of what I like to call the good old boy system of wholesale distribution, right? And everybody was protected. Everybody in that supply chain was protected, right? And really, they almost were in this privileged position of the God kings of the supply chain. And now all of a sudden that entire monopoly of the supply chain has been broken. And we had some manufacturers that were newer manufacturers who decided to go direct to the B2B buyer. And they decided to mediate that either through EDI or through e-commerce. And we also have a new phenomenon, which I'm seeing is also a motivator to my clients to start thinking about e-commerce. We have digitally native wholesale distribution brands being set up, where they've never had a field sales team. They have always been digitally native. And all of a sudden now they're doing B2B buyer acquisition, customer acquisition online because they've ungated their catalog. So when someone's looking for widget X, they can actually find it by Googling it and say, oh, this is the supplier of widget X that I need. Cool. I'm going to start and live my relationship with the supplier completely digitally. I will have zero expectation that I'll have a sales rep turn up at my door at any point. And so I think this is putting pressure on these legacy businesses to adapt. Otherwise, they're just going to go out of business. And what they're going to find, especially distributors that have onerous supply requirements, onerous MOQs, onerous payment methods, onerous payment terms, if a distributor doesn't bring value to the table other than, oh, I can sell you widget X, they're gonna pretty soon find themselves out of business, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I give you a great example of a friend of mine who has a big merchandise business. And he rang me, even probably pre-COVID, it's all B2B. And he said, I said, how are things? He said, not good. Nobody rings me anymore. And I said, Robert, they don't want to ring you anymore. They only want to ring you if they have an issue. If they have, we know the rise in B2C automation, that's happening in B2B as well. Okay. Customers want to be able to self-service. They don't want to have to talk to you. You talk, I have teenage kids and you ring them and all you get back in WhatsApp is a question mark.
Is there something wrong? Is the house burning?
Oh, I want to talk to you. And it is that mindset. And it's really interesting that you mentioned, I know LinkedIn and B2B Institute have done some great research around this new B2B buyer and their goals and what they're into. And that I'm educating clients to say, guys, this is who your buyers are now under 30. And these are the guys who you need to impress. It's not the old school, as you say, the monopolies anymore. It's really, how do we meet customer expectations? Because customer expectations are driven by B2C. They're going on Amazon, they're going on Nike, they're going on Adidas, they're getting seamless customer journeys, seamless customer experience. And they're going, this is what I want every time, every company that I deal with, whether I'm doing it at work or whether I'm doing it at home.
And I think we're also in a situation where some of the B2B buyers, if they're in a relatively small organization, they don't have a dedicated buyer necessarily. It might be the person literally on the shop floor or in the engineering department, or it could be a heavy diesel mechanic or something like that. And the person who's literally working on the machinery and equipment during the day, when he gets home at the end of the night and he's sitting on his couch with his family in front of the TV, he maybe has his iPad and he goes, oh God, I've got to order these 20 things for this job that I'm doing tomorrow. I don't really have time. And my sales rep, he's at home. I can't pick up the phone and call my sales rep because it's after hours. And I don't want to send a fax through anymore. I don't necessarily want to send an email with a spreadsheet attached of these 53 things that I need. I want to just be able to find out all the information, find out fitment information, make sure I'm ordering the right item, do all my research online, do my purchase online, and just have it turn up at my doorstep for this job that I'm doing over the next week, or turn up at the building site because, yay, we've got this project on and it's time crunched. And so I think the B2B buyer is sometimes not as sophisticated as the B2B seller would like them to be in terms of, hey, these buyers, they're just as time pressured and they're just as margin pressured as the seller is. So the reality is you have to remove friction from that buying process because ultimately that drops to the bottom line of the buyer. The faster and more seamless you can make it for them, the quicker they can turn that product around that they bought from you and make money from it.
What will happen is they'll make money from it, but that also drives loyalty. Because if they know, I can talk to Jason and I know I can go on the app at 10 o'clock at night or on the website and stuff has arrived at site the next day, I'm not even gonna look at other suppliers unless I have to when the time comes around to order again. And it is that kind of leap over from B2C customer experience and matching that CX that you get from a B2C brand that you get in B2B. Another thing, what I'm seeing lately is I'm seeing a lot of, as you would say, the traditional sellers coming on. Well, I have a program that I developed in customer experience and behavior. And 80% of the people in the room that are coming on these cohorts are B2B buyers. The people that we spoke about at the start that are going, oh my God, we don't do any marketing. I don't know anything about marketing. Where do we start? And they're using CX as their gateway into trying to understand what does this world look like. I had one traditional concrete salesman and I asked him, why did you come on the program? He said, because I'm afraid my job will be gone. I'm a salesman. He said, I need to get up to speed with what consumers are doing. I need to get up to speed with kind of understand the customer journey, and I have to create value for my customers. And by creating value for my customers, I'm creating value for the organization long term.
And I'd love to know whether you're seeing a similar shift to what I'm seeing in the market, which is sometimes when I get brought in fact, I would say greater than 50% of the time I get brought in to discuss B2B e-commerce capability in these manufacturers, wholesalers, and distributors. When I first arrive there, the sales team usually eyes me with a great deal of suspicion. They see me as the enemy at the gates. They see me as the person who's going to threaten their entire livelihood and their entire business model. And they really hate the fact that I'm even in the building virtually, usually, until I start talking to them and until I start helping them realize I'm actually their biggest ally and I'm actually their biggest cheerleader and I'm actually the person who's probably going to give them more longevity in the industry than without me. And I'm actually a massive advocate for sales teams. I'm an incredible advocate. And I believe that digital enablement is the name of the game, not digital replacement, and digital augmentation as opposed to digital replacement. And usually by the end of a half an hour conversation, the sales team really loves me because what I find that I'm helping them understand is that the things about their job that they hate the most, which is the admin function that they fulfill as part of their role, if we could take away the admin work, if we can take away 80 to 90% of the admin work that they're doing every day that adds no value to them or their customer, all of a sudden their eyes light up and they're going, oh, you mean you're not going to take away my commissions? Oh, if someone buys through the website, I'm still going to get credit for that sale because they're my named account. Oh, okay, cool. Now the guard comes down and all of a sudden now we can have a dialogue about, okay, what cohort of your customers would adopt digital technology tomorrow if you offered it? Which ones are going to need a little bit more encouragement, a little bit more onboarding, a little bit more support? What does that onboarding journey, both internally and externally, look like? What does that adoption plan look like? Because at the end of the day, in most of these B2B brands and businesses, you will never get customer adoption until you get sales adoption, salesperson and sales team adoption, because it's those sales teams that are literally going to sit on a chair next to their customer and help them go, okay, let's log you in for the first time. Let's help you navigate this new website. Let's help you understand how this journey works. We've created your account for you. Now you just need to go in and create your own password. I'm going to literally handhold by your side, the first 1, 2, 3 orders that you do online, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to make sure that this goes smoothly for you. And if you have any problems, I'm going to take this back to the office and I'm going to make sure this gets sorted for you. And so this relationship piece from an adoption perspective is absolutely critical. If you don't have the internal team on the bus, you will never be able to get customers on the bus.
No, absolutely. So to my mind, you have to have 100%, you have to have the internal team on the bus. But you have to have them. And what I found is a lot of traditional salespeople who are now looking at B2B or at e-commerce and looking at CX, they're going, okay, we know our customers, but we don't really understand them. Okay, if that makes sense. So we know that's Matt, that's John, and we know that's what they do. But I'm working with a client at the moment that says, okay, how can we improve the relationship with them? Oh, we already have a good relationship. I said, no, well, think a little bit deeper. How can we have us going to them while them coming to us? So we're always one step ahead of them. So maybe we're doing, and one client at the moment, we're doing persona development work. Very basic, simple. This is the type of client we have. So if we want client this like this, we can get lots of clients like this. And education, while I'm in education and I'm a consultant, education forms a huge part of my consultancy. It's because it's exciting. This is a new frontier. This is opportunity, as you say. This isn't the end of the world. This is how can we use these new tools, AI, e-commerce, things that are CX buzzwords that they feel maybe are alien to them, but incorporate them into the world and help them build a bigger business.
And oftentimes I get peppered with questions by sales teams. How are we going to enforce our MOQs? How are we going to enforce our buying increments? How are we going to get the right technical information to make sure that the customer orders the right item? Because, you know, I'm Mr. or Miss Salesperson and I'm dealing with the customer, and half the time when they place an order, it's wrong and I fix it for them. And I make sure that the line items are correct. And I make sure that this item works with this item because my buyer is not really up to speed with all of that. And when you start stepping through each one of those objections one by one, and you say, actually, the digital technology is mature enough now to be able to do all those things you do manually in your head, or at least 80% of it. And maybe it's only for 80% of your catalog. Maybe it's not for 100% of your catalog. But it doesn't mean we don't do e-commerce because e-commerce can't support 100% of your catalog. It means this is a journey, not a destination. And it's not a one and done project. None of these digital projects are one and done projects. This is an evolution, not only for you, but it's an evolution for your customer too. This is a journey we're all on together. And it's not like you're going to put $100,000 into a new e-commerce website and that's it. You call it good and everybody walks away and it just ticks on behind the scenes. No, this is a long-term investment. And where I find that the investment usually needs to take place, even before we start thinking about e-commerce or technology or processes, it's we need to get your data in a good place, because 9 times out of 10, their product data and their customer data are an absolute shambles, an absolute disaster. And there's no consistency to it. It's spread between 4 or 5 different systems, network drives, physical catalogs, salespeople's heads. And the first thing we need to do is we need to look at, okay, where's the data and what kind of state is it in? And that's where I think probably 20 to 30 to 40, maybe 50% of my consulting is on the data front before we ever start thinking of a digital roadmap. Are you finding that too?
Absolutely. And it's very timely that you should mention it because I've kind of taken on a new client recently. And that's exactly what we're doing. There's maybe a lack of trust around CRM systems. So everything that they have is on their network drive, as you say. Every client has a folder. And I'm going back 20 years ago here to the way it used to be. But everything is still done it's a multi-million euro business. Everything is still done in Word documents. Okay, when they're trying to size everything up to make it look good, we're going, guys, there is a much easier way to do this. But as you say, we have to look, find out where the data is, map the customer personas, map the customer journey, and use the data to help us win in that space.
And the other thing I find also is that in a lot of these businesses, they'll have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 spreadsheets of pricing for each customer. And they'll say, okay, they'll maybe generate a new price list in a spreadsheet with some macros that they'll update maybe once a quarter and they'll send it to their customer, but nothing gets updated in between those major updates. And what we find, and I find this really regularly, is that they will literally have an individual, unique, bespoke price list per customer. And when they start thinking about how can we manage our forecasting, how can we roadmap out to make sure that as we do our modeling of any pricing changes moving forward, we maybe want to control our margins. We maybe want to, maybe we want to subsidize certain ranges or products when we first enter the market with them, but then we need to quickly get to a place of profitability within the next 12 to 18 months. It becomes very difficult to do any kind of modeling when every single customer has their own unique price on every single SKU in the catalog. It becomes really difficult. And it becomes really difficult to plan as a business. And it becomes really difficult to scale as a business when you have no consistency across anything. And I find that when you start having discussions with these brands and you say, okay, let's take a really hard look, because oftentimes they use the term organic. Our negotiations happen organically and our pricing happens organically. Sure, we make a minimum margin on everything. We negotiate these price lists really closely with our trade partners. But when we start taking a really empirical look at this, what we usually find is that give or take, every single one of these price lists and every single one of these customers could be put in 1, 2, or 3, 4 tiers worth of pricing. And sure, we may have to round up a little bit or round down a little bit, but we could actually put our customers and we could put incentives in place at each of those tiers that make sense and are really transparent to us and our customer and say, look, if you get up to this unit volume, or if you get up to this 12-month trailing spend or whatever it might be, then you move up into the next tier of discounting. And it all of a sudden gives your customer an incentive to bring more and more of their business under your roof. And it's very similar to how in the B2C and D2C world, we've said, okay, here's your free shipping thresholds. Here's your loyalty program. Here's your membership program. B2C has nailed this 10 years ago, but B2B is only just starting to figure this out. And this whole individual negotiation with every single customer on every single line item is an antiquated way of looking at things, to my way of thinking.
To my way as well, like you hit the nail on the head, and it goes back to what I mentioned earlier about value. You're creating so much more value for your customers if you're putting them into these 2, 3, or 4 tiers and you're giving them the incentives. And they're so used to doing things like this in D2C and B2C that this is great. I wish all of my suppliers had a system like this. But sometimes it's about opening the client's minds to the opportunities that are out there, as well as the education piece. It's opening their minds and listen, guys, this is going to make your world so much easier. Just bear with us for a second. And the common one I get is, as you say, that the sales guy is going, what's that got to do with advertising? This has nothing to do with advertising. Yes, I'm a marketing consultant, but this is about kind of creation of value, making your lives easier and building a bigger business for yourselves.
And this whole customer loyalty thing in the B2B world, customer loyalty used to be built in. It was built in because customers had a gun to their head and they had nowhere else usually that they could buy the goods. Now they can shop internationally for suppliers and they can go direct to China. They can go direct to Mexico where I'm based now. They've got options. Whereas before they didn't have options. So now, apart from just having the goods in stock, you got to add some kind of value beyond just having the goods available at any given point in time. And it can't just be price. It can't be that just you're the cheapest, because I know that when I had my business. Back in the day, I had my own e-commerce pure play with a business partner, and we were dual shoring. So we were selling memory cards when memory cards were brand new into the market for cameras and cell phones, et cetera. And I've told this story before on the podcast, but I think it's worth repeating. We would parallel import. So we would import off of retailers in some instances, sometimes off of distributors, and sometimes off of manufacturers outside New Zealand. We would warehouse the products locally and we ship it directly to the end consumer in more like a direct to consumer fashion. But what we found was that sometimes we would pay a little bit more for a good if we could get more of the range that we were looking for. But if they provided a digital interface that was super easy to use, track our orders, as opposed to having to send spreadsheets back and forth. And some suppliers were just an absolute, it was almost like they didn't want your money. They were almost impossible to deal with. Some suppliers, super easy. Log in through a buyer portal, see all your information, see your previous purchases, have your shopping lists, have your customer-specific pricing, see your MOQs, see, so for example, let's say they were out of stock of an item that you wanted, they would show the inbound due date, the quantity that was inbound. They would tell you, okay, cool, you can place your order now, but we're going to ship these 5 items, but you're going to have to wait for the 6th and we'll ship that in 2 weeks. Basically, some suppliers had their shit sorted. And oh my God, we would pay for the convenience of dealing with suppliers like that. In some instances, they're 5, 10, 15, 20% more expensive than another supplier. But if the other supplier is that painful to deal with, I'll pay a premium for convenience. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of B2B suppliers, they think that the convenience factor is only important in the B2C world. It is potentially even more important in the B2B world because your buyers, they're doing it as part of their day job. They have to be efficient at what they're doing. It's not a luxury for them to be making these purchases. They have no choice but to make these purchases. And if I'm going to have to go and do my day job of a purchasing manager every single day, I'm going to work with people that are easy to deal with as a supplier.
So this goes back to old school marketing theory, where you've got a continuum, you've got goods on one side of the continuum, and there used to always be salt when I was learning marketing, and you have services on the other. I'll come into shot here. You have services on the other side of the continuum, okay? And there was like your pure goods or pure services. Everything is at this end of the continuum now, okay? And what I feel is that a lot of B2B sellers and marketers don't really understand that, yes, you're shipping the goods, but you're at this end as well, okay? So you're at this end, so you can deliver that, excuse my language, shit-hot service that will ensure that when that customer has that problem again, they will come. They will trust you. Builds trust. It builds loyalty. And when they have the problem again, you're an automatic choice. And so I think we need to try and get back to that loyalty that was already built in B2B as much as we can. But we're never going to get back to the way it was. But I think there's an opportunity if you can really improve your CX, like really make it top end, that your B2B buyers are just going to have no choice but to go anywhere else.
Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening. And how often do you go into these B2B brands and see even the fact that they have a marketer? Like, many B2B brands I work with, they don't have a marketing team. They don't even necessarily have a marketing person. They've got a sales manager who then is expected to also fulfill the marketing function. And maybe their sales team is drumming up business by going and knocking on doors, and they treat that as marketing. But how often do you go into these B2B brands and they even have a marketer?
Very rare, because they don't need me. Doesn't mean we don't have a marketing person. So you're going in, as you're saying, and I like to think of it as a set of dots, but there's dots everywhere. That the dots aren't joined up. So we've got the salesperson, and then what's the next step we take? So the marketing stroke salesperson, that generally there's maybe an onboarding if it's a software type product, and then there's going to be service afterwards. And again, it's about having all of those three, and sometimes there's 4 or 5 different elements of your business on the one page. So the customer's going, Yeah, the sales team were brilliant. The marketing was great, but when we got to onboarding, it was a disaster. So it's about having that consistency as well, right across the customer journey.
I think you raise a very good point, which is that in the B2C world, most brands have long since realized that everything is marketing. Everything to do, every single touch point, every single instance of a customer coming in contact with your brand is marketing. So if they send a live chat message with a request, that's marketing. If they pick up the phone and they call you, that's marketing. If they send you an email with a problem or a question pre-purchase, that's marketing. Fulfillment is marketing. The unboxing experience is marketing. You know, the quality of the product is marketing. The range is marketing. Product availability is marketing. Basically, every single function in the business, whether we want to recognize it or not, is marketing. And it's either good marketing or it's bad marketing. It's either generating desire for us and our brand and our products, or it's becoming a repellent for us, our brand and our products. And I think B2B has seemingly been a little bit late to that party where everything in the business is marketing, and they put it in a box and they say, that's the coloring in department's problem. Us in the real sales world here, we're boots on the ground and we're really trying to drive revenue for this business. So don't bother me with this marketing bullshit. And I think that B2B brands now are slowly really starting to wake up to the fact that everything in this business is marketing, whether we like it or not.
They are. So marketing, so there's a couple of things in that. Okay, so first of all, marketing has probably been its own worst enemy, okay, in terms of some of the highfalutin ideas that it's come out with. So I've always called myself as the kind of worst advocate for pure marketing, because I think pure marketing shouldn't be that kind of cost center, long boozy lunches, madmen type scenario. Then it has to be something that's going to drive profit for the organization. Okay, so that's the first one. And I think there's a skepticism, and in some instances, quite rightly so. There's a skepticism around marketing and around, oh, here's another fluffy term that's not going to last for too long. Okay, so there's that one. And the second one, as you say, it's not that every touch point, yes, every touch point is marketing, but every touch point is an opportunity to speak to your customer. Every touch point is an opportunity to form a thought in their brain. Isn't that really cool? The way they did send that box, isn't that really cool? The way my expectations were managed, isn't that really cool? I knew exactly where I stood and I had no problem getting a refund, and there was no issue getting in contact with a sales team, or even I didn't need to speak to the sales guy. I was able to talk to the chatbot, but the chatbot was programmed by the sales guy.
I tell you, it's so amazing that I really have a love and a passion for B2B brands, because I think they've got the, in most cases, not all cases, but in most cases, they've got the core constituents to be amazing brands. Like to be, I think we focus a little bit too much on the McMaster cars, the Caterpillars, I think we focus too much on a small selection of multi-billion dollar B2B brands that are in many instances actually just marketplaces. They've actually turned their brand into a marketplace. So they get to clip the ticket on every transaction that goes through that particular vertical. But I think it's actually the mid-market brands. So we're talking B2B brands that are doing somewhere between 20 and say $300 million in revenue that are still for the large part, the most part, privately owned, privately run, oftentimes family-owned businesses that are maybe now on their second and third generation. They are the ones that actually have the ability to differentiate, but they don't even realize it. It is this deep, rich institutional knowledge of a vertical, of a space that they play in, that is so valuable, but they don't even realize it. They don't see the value of it. And the only way that they can see exposing that value to the customer today is a poor field salesperson that's got to hit 5 calls a month on his call cycle. I think they are just doing themselves a dramatic disservice based on what they actually could achieve, because they actually do care. They actually are in love with the vertical they work in because they've been doing it for generations. And I think B2B brands, there are so many B2B brands that are under the radar right now that once they're no longer under the radar, they have an opportunity to absolutely own the verticals that they are in, to the point where they can, using the case studies of the biggest companies, B2B companies in the world, isn't really that helpful. I actually think that now that I've started to go to physical conferences again, thank God, after COVID, seeing the stories, the success stories of mid-market brands that are doing really innovative things to service their customers. And it's not taking them a ton of money. It's not taking them a huge amount of effort. It's just all we're doing is we're translating a whole lot of these analog things that they do day to day into digital equivalents, and just getting there, just translating the analog services we provide into digital equivalents for many brands, that's enough. That is earth shattering for them as a brand, and it's earth shattering for their customers. And they don't even realize it.
No, they don't. So tell you what they have. And I've worked with one client in the past that had such a long history in service that they were just known for the exceptional service that they provide. Okay. And they had built up that trust. But then what happens is you see new brands popping up that don't have a history or heritage. And they're calling themselves brands, but all they are logo. Whereas this, we go back to the companies that have the history, they don't even realize how good they are in service. And so we're in the process of trying to move them into the digital space. And they're nearly afraid to talk to their customers, nearly afraid to, oh, we don't want to send a customer an email as a reminder because we might annoy them. This kind of outset, the mindset. So there's been a pivot back to brands like that, but I absolutely agree with you. There's no point in showing them the Caterpillar case studies, as you say. It's a bit like showing B2C organizations, Netflix or Disney. They're just, yeah, that doesn't relate to us. If we can't see it, we can't be it. So show me something. And I'm a big proponent, and when I'm onboarding a client, I'm getting similar case studies of similar sized organizations, similar type brands to them, and saying, this is what these guys have done. Why can't you do it?
And I think that they also have an expectation that it's going to cost them $1 million to do it. And I think that, yes, B2B is expensive. It's complex. It's these B2B projects on average tend to be 25 to maybe 50% more expensive than equivalent B2C project. And usually we've got some fairly complex integrations with ERPs and other places, other components in the stack, the supply chain. Maybe they need a PIM because they've never had a PIM before and they've got data that they need to organize in better ways using better systems. So I'm not trying to say it's cheap, but it's definitely much, much cheaper than it ever used to be. And we don't have to boil the ocean, is what I tell my clients. We don't have to boil the ocean in an initial project. So let's take out the 20% of the catalog that requires massive CPQ capability. So if you've got some really complex products that require really complex configuration and maybe some consultation along the way and maybe some services to go along with it, then let's let that continue to go through your salespeople and let's let that continue to happen maybe in an analog way for now. And let's take the other part of your catalog that we can easily put online. And maybe all we focus on for phase one, the only thing we focus on is replenishment ordering. That's it. Replenishment ordering. If you've got customers that are ordering the same stuff over and over again on a regular basis, and they've got a fairly standard shopping list, they shouldn't have to go through a sales rep for replenishment orders. They just shouldn't have to. They want to order online. You want them to order online. Let's value add in another way. So let's really create something that you and your customers will see massive value from that we can call an MVP, a minimum viable product or a minimum viable experience. Let's bring that online first. Let's take the easiest, lowest hanging fruit and lowest hanging pieces of the experience that we can digitalize here. Let's introduce live chat so that your customer service people, for example, instead of only taking phone calls and only taking help desk requests, now all of a sudden they can maybe take two or three live chats at once, and let's enable them with some out of the box responses for common questions. Let's bring a chatbot in for the initial response. If it's basic stuff, where's my order, the WISMO requests, all that sort of stuff, order editing. Let's make it possible for them to edit existing orders digitally. Let's make it possible. And this is a really common use case, and I'd love to know whether you're seeing this too. In the B2B world, 9 out of 10 orders are not finalized until they are validated in the ERP. So someone will order 100 units of this, 100 units of that, whatever it might be. Here's these 20 line items, and then it goes through. But they've got to validate that they've actually got the items in stock. They've got to validate which warehouse they're going to fulfill it from. They've got to validate the timing. They've got to validate a whole bunch of stuff. And oftentimes those orders will get edited before they're accepted or processed. Now, at least digitally, once that's finalized in the ERP, we can now update that order in the e-commerce system via system integration to where when the customer logs in, they see the actual order that we're going to ship to them. They can see their actual invoices. They can see their actual statements. They can make payments against statements online. So I think if we can say, look, there's a bunch of low-hanging fruit here that is not going to break your back operationally. In fact, we're going to actually offload some of these labor-intensive functions within the business that are operationally intensive, and we're going to convert these into digital equivalents, which is actually going to unburden you to be able to think about, okay, this is our MVP to get us live, but what could we do that would surprise and delight our customers after that? Let's just baby step this. Let's roadmap this out in a way that makes sense to the business. It isn't going to break the back of the business. And I think that by helping our brands that we work dip their toes in the digital waters, it makes it less scary.
You're holding their hand, okay?
Yeah.
And you take them on and say, we're going to cross the road here, guys. Okay, now we're just going to look both ways before we go, okay? And to me, it's always about showing, getting those quick wins, showing value early, building that trust as a consultant that they go, these guys are going to keep us on the right track, okay? So, and having them understand that this is an iterative process, that this is going to be step by step and it's going to be a loop. This isn't, as you say, this isn't your $100,000 and you've got your e-commerce website. That it doesn't work like this. It really is a mindset shift.
And I'd love to know your thoughts on this. The brands that I work with that start to see data as an opportunity center as opposed to a cost center are the ones that I see winning the most. Because if they are willing to put an ongoing investment into product data, maintenance, updating, enhancing, enriching, extending, the brands that are willing to do that over time and not look at it as one and done, the brands that are willing to invest in the collection of excellent customer data and the ability to collect data on how customers are using the website, maybe put into place a CDP, putting into place a really good marketing automation platform that's collecting and utilizing this zero and first party data like D2C and B2C have been doing for years. The brands that are willing to see data as an asset and make continual investments in that, these are the guys I think that will see the best results. Whereas if they see it as purely a cost center, oh my God, we're going to have to spend $50,000 to cleanse our data. Oh my God, before we even start thinking about building an e-commerce channel. Oh my God, that's ridiculous, right? But they have to take a little bit longer term view to this. And if they can do that, these are the ones that win.
These are the ones that win. So for those that can invest in data, but those have the ability to use the data. So that data has to be turned into an insight. And that insight has to be turned into an action. Okay, so again, it's about, and I worked with one client during COVID who couldn't, like that investment piece, had all this brilliant data, but couldn't afford to employ a data scientist to drill down into what the data was able to tell them. And what, again, then this sort of creativity from a marketing perspective goes in. That's an interesting insight to the customer. How can we build on this? How can we use this to create better products, better brands, and a better business?
No question about that. And there's some really good off-the-shelf BI tooling. There's some really good off-the-shelf CDP technology. There's some really good off-the-shelf marketing automation technology. Search, merchandising, personalization on the front end of the e-commerce website. It used to be even 2 to 5 years ago, search merchandising and personalization was only for the B2C world. It didn't take into account things like custom price lists, configure price quote functionality, product variants. It didn't take into account a lot of that stuff. But now there are platforms out there that do. And so there's a lot more drop-in technology that caters for B2B merchants than ever before. And so it's not like we got to go out and build everything from scratch. We're not reinventing the wheel here. And this is what I'm trying to help a lot of brands understand is that, sure, 2 to 5 years ago, the technology was not really there for B2B brands. It was really still quite nascent. It's maturing very rapidly. And even Shopify, vaunted B2C, D2C platform Shopify is starting to get religion around B2B. And they, for the last 18 months, have been creating B2B on Shopify for their Plus merchants. It's not there yet for a lot of use cases, but man, are they making some massive investments in the space. So when Shopify starts to get on board the B2B train, that B2B train's probably already left the station.
It definitely is. And lost my train of thought there, what I was going to say to you, it's gone.
That's all right. I think you'd agree that technology has come a long way for B2B brands over the last 5 years.
What I was going to say, technology has come such a long way for B2B brands. But what I'm finding still, though, it's nearly, if the clients are gone, we have this problem. And they go, there's three or four solutions we could look. Oh, and I never realized, we've been too busy doing our job to focus on what's out there. So a lot of what I'm bringing to the table nowadays is, here's solutions. Okay, here's like basic level CRM solution. Or as you say, those other solutions that are open to you, let's look at these BI solutions. Let's see what we can do. And it's not, as you say, it's not going to cost the earth, moon, and stars to get that done.
Absolutely. And sometimes they've already got the great foundations of the technology in their business. Maybe it requires a little bit of enhanced system integration to share data across systems in ways that they never thought of before, that all of a sudden now, wow, okay, cool. I'm sharing data between my ERP to my CRM to my e-commerce platform and back again. And now I'm able to actually close the loop on a lot of these behavioral enrichment things that are coming from the website. And knowing the categories they're buying from, knowing frequencies, understanding preferences, all that sort of stuff. I think that there's a lot of smart integrations that can happen inside these businesses that before, without really good integration middleware that could deal with flat files and legacy systems that don't have APIs, et cetera, now we can actually integrate systems together that historically have been almost impossible to integrate. And therefore, we can share, instead of having everything be siloed in the business, now we can break apart those silos and we can actually let marketing do marketing's job, but inform sales, let sales inform marketing, let the web experience be enriched for the customer, but also sending all of that data back into our back office system so that we understand the customer better and we treat them like an individual as opposed to a massive cohort of customers. So I think today, through modern system integration, brands can get more longevity out of existing systems than ever before too.
Yeah, absolutely. They know their business so well that to me, this is a really exciting time. And it's nearly about saying, guys, just take a step back for a second. Let's see what could be done. We don't have to do it all tomorrow. But if we look at this and we make it, we plan it, and I always go, let's see what could we do if we want to do everything in the world. And then we take it from there. So we work in a project plan from there.
And if you were to go into, when you go into a brand for the very first time today, and I don't know, let's say they're a $50 million a year B2B brand. They're a really legacy business. They've never done e-commerce before. This is their first even peek or thought. Hey, maybe we ought to think about this e-commerce thing. What is the first one, two, or three things you do when you get into these brands when they're starting thinking about this digital transformation journey, for lack of a better term? Where do you start with these brands usually to help, I guess, bring down the anxiety, bring down the fear level, lower the cortisol levels in the room to where everybody feels like, hey, guys, don't stress, don't worry. We're going to go through a stepped, orderly process here that's going to get everybody on the train. We're going to make this, instead of disruptive to the business, we're going to make this transformational for the business. What are the first one, two, or three things you do when you first get inside a business?
First of all, it depends on the room. So it depends on the client, depends on who, on what level that cortisol level is at. Okay. It depends on, as you say, in my business and your business, a lot of very traditional businesses where there is at the C level, they don't really trust you. So the first thing you do is you build that trust. Okay. Secondly, going back to what we spoke earlier, is you show them case studies of others like them who have been on this journey. And then thirdly, what you do is you show them potential. Not when I get too deep into it, show them potential wins that we can make here. So you create scenarios where for our four product persona, four customer personas, here's what success looks like for them. And then you make them write, get the PO or sign the check.
Yeah, I like to say one of my favorite sayings, especially in the B2B world, is you ask better questions, you get better answers. For me, I try to demonstrate expertise and an understanding of their vertical, of their market, of the B2B space. I try to demonstrate that by asking really good, insightful questions. And for me, that starts, it's probably the questions I ask that builds more trust than the answers I give. And it's, oh, wow, you really understand the nuances of our industry. You really understand the nuances of B2B. Gosh, you're really asking some very deep questions about how we operate as a business. Now, automatically, because you're showing interest in them and you're showing interest in how they do things, I find that oftentimes builds trust faster than anything else.
It does. Like, I had this conversation with a colleague of mine today saying, clients don't want to see 45 minutes of the projects you've worked on in the past. They want to see you on the initial meeting, show them how you can help them with a little bit of, this is what we've done in the past if you want to check it out.
Yes, absolutely. And I find that testimonials, especially video testimonials, which I've tried to put onto my website and I'm trying to increase all the time, trying to just get more and more video on there. I find that really makes a difference, because if they can see themselves in one of your past customers and in a similar sort of way, and they can connect the dots that way, then it's like, oh, okay, he obviously knows how to work with us because he's worked with someone like us before. Hey, listen, Joe, this has been a fantastic conversation. I think we're both absolutely in love with and passionate about the B2B space, and especially B2B e-commerce, you especially from the CX, UX, and marketing side, me probably more from the tech and operational side. And look, I think what I'm noticing is that a lot of people who came from maybe more of a heavy B2C, D2C background, as I did for many years, I worked in the B2C and D2C e-commerce space for many years before I decided to get real serious and real hardcore about B2B because I fell in love with it. I find that there's more of us now who have made that pivot into the B2B space. And I think that's going to have to continue to happen. We are going to have to bring more people from the dark side of B2C and D2C. We're going to have to bring more people from the dark side into B2B, because there's just not enough resources still to this day. There's not enough resources. If I have B2B brands ask me all the time, can you help me hire an e-commerce manager? Can you help me find an e-commerce manager? And usually, more often than not, what we find is instead of trying to go to market to find an e-commerce manager, it's more we take someone inside their organization and who's really an expert on them, their business, their vertical, B2B, full stop. And then we upskill them on the e-commerce side, because oftentimes it's easier to do that than it is to try to go to market and find a unicorn, or I call them unicorns, which is somebody who's an expert in B2B and who's an expert in e-commerce and digital. Like, trying to find people like that have all those skills in one box without having to pay them $500,000 a year, it's just really difficult to find. And most of those people will have gone consulting. If they're really good and they know B2B and they know e-com and digital, they've usually gone consulting like you and me, and they don't want to be an employee anymore. So I find that these brands, and is this a, you know, the brands that you work with, when they want to build a capability in-house around this, sure, they're going to need partners. They're going to need implementation partners. They're going to need agencies. They're going to need people like you and me. But if they want to build that muscle of digital and e-commerce inside the business and build that capability in that department within the business, how do you advise them? What do you recommend that they do to do that?
I would go the very same route as you. If we can find it in-house, absolutely, let's do it. As I said, I'm a huge believer in education and bringing people up, because everybody can learn new skills. And once you have a flair for it, you've got a great opportunity to bring people on that journey with you. So first call is to find somebody in-house. Secondly, is try and convince somebody to come from the dark side. Okay, because anyone that I know who's come from the dark side prefers the light side. I do some work in B2C, but I would much prefer, even my work in B2C is very challenger brands or brands that don't necessarily have a marketing focus. But yeah, come from the dark side.
Yeah, absolutely. The light side. Joe, absolutely love this. And now as we come down to the end of our time together, this is the point where I love to turn the microphone over to my guest. I love to let them ask me one question. Any question they like can be personal or professional. So, Joe Wild from Mac Digital, what is your question for me today?
Why Mexico?
Oh, man, that's such a great question. I could probably spend an hour talking about it. You may have heard of this little country called New Zealand, and you may have heard the stories about how difficult it was during COVID and how badly the country was locked down. That was, I think, the kind of the last straw, I think, for us to leave New Zealand. My wife's a Kiwi. My grandfather was a Kiwi. My brother-in-law's a Kiwi. I have strong ties to New Zealand. I'm a dual citizen. But I think there was a few catalysts, but COVID was that last straw. We're never going to put ourselves in that position again, where we're at the mercy of a closed border country for multiple years at a time. And this is not the last pandemic we're going to see. And so we wanted to get to a place that was a little bit more free. And we felt that Mexico handled the COVID much better than New Zealand did. Stayed free, kept the borders open. They took reasonable precautions, but they didn't shut down the country and kill the economy in the process. So we felt that this was a great place to be. Secondarily, being closer to the North American market, I already had some North America-based clients. I think that there's a lot happening both in the UK and the US from an e-commerce perspective. Massive amounts of opportunity, lots of conferences and opportunities to meet people in the industry. So that was a big draw card for me. Lower cost of living, weather, food, culture. There's a lot of things there. But to be honest, if I had to point to one single thing, it would be the freedom factor. Mexico is, there's a lot of freedom in Mexico. You can, it's a very live and let live. I think the Latin cultures are very live and let live anyway. And it's understood that people just get on with their lives here. And I love that about the culture. So there was a lot of attractions, but those are the biggies.
Right. Thanks, Mel.
Listen, Joe, this has been fantastic. If people want to get a hold of you, I'll drop your LinkedIn profile in the show notes. I'll also put the link to Mac Digital in the show notes. But if anybody wants to reach out to you and talk to you about B2B, digital, marketing, e-commerce, how should they get a hold of you?
LinkedIn or Joe, J-O-E, at macdigital.ie.
Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? Then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.